1995 is probably the closest I've ever come to just giving up on WWE. I think that was the year, the first time where I really felt like that was nearly my breaking point. We had, you know, a roster back then. Yeah, I look back on it now, you know, I could appreciate a lot of the talent they had on the roster and some of the great matches that took place that year in the company. But it was probably around February of that year. It's about a month, month and a half maybe before WrestleMania. And I can remember watching, it had to be Superstars. I'm guessing it was probably Superstars, one of the syndicated shows on the weekend. And I just remember watching an Allied Powers match. It was British Bulldog and Lex Luger against maybe the Blue Brother. Actually, that was the WrestleMania match. But I'm just watching the, and I'm just like, I'm not into this. Like, this is boring. You know, like, I wasn't as excited as I used to be. And I think everybody, when you're younger like that, you all have friends where you get to that point, they either just stop watching because they either lose interest or, oh, it's fake or whatever, and they sort of drop off. And then you have the people who don't. The people like me, the schmucks like me, who stick with it, stayed fans, didn't mind all that, kept watching. But that was almost my breaking point in 1995. It was also the same year that gave us a lot of guys who had to work apparently two jobs. Boy, we think the economy now is bad. Back then, these guys had to take two jobs. They were moonlighting as wrestlers. During the day, they had all different kinds of jobs. We had the wrestling garbage man, right? Duke the Dumpster Drozzy. We had the wrestling dentist, Isaac Yankum DDS. We had the wrestling plumber, T.L. Hopper. We had the wrestling teacher, Dean Douglas, with the screeching of the blackboard. We have Mantar, right? Half man, half tar, I guess. Whatever it was that he did. The goon. Let's not forget the goon, all you hockey fans out there. That was almost Chris Jericho's gimmick. Chris Jericho had the opportunity. I think Jim Cornette came to him and said, listen, we got this gimmick. Because, you know, Chris Jericho's father was a famous hockey player, right? Ted Irvine played for the New York Rangers. We have this great gimmick for you. Boy, did he dodge a bullet on that one. All these crazy gimmicks. Although I will say, we did get Waylon Mercy. We did get Waylon Mercy that year. It's too bad Danny Spivey's body was too broken down by that point in his career. Couldn't do much with it. Those eyes, when they would zoom in on those eyes, they used to freak me out. But it was not a good year business-wise. Now, you could talk about all the talent they had. Bret, Shawn, Owen, Hakushi, Waltman. They had a lot of talented guys. Business-wise, not a good year. They were losing fans. Fewer people were buying the pay-per-views. And thus, a new pay-per-view concept was born. Pay-per-view concept called In Your House. 25 years ago, in May of 1995. And the idea was that if we lower the cost of the shows, right? We're going to lower the length of the shows instead of having three-hour pay-per-views every month. Because they weren't having monthly pay-per-views back then. We still had the Royal Rumble. We had WrestleMania. We had King of the Ring, SummerSlam, Survivor Series. I kind of miss those days, to be honest with you, just keeping it to those five core events. So they weren't doing monthly shows. But the idea is we can do monthly shows and kind of fill the gaps. But we won't have these three-hour blowouts. We'll charge a little bit less. So that was the whole point of the concept. And the idea was we'll bring back some of those people who stopped buying the pay-per-views because some of the buy rates were just dreadful back then. And maybe we'll even entice some new fans, you know, almost like a miniaturized version of our pay-per-views. And maybe we'll entice some new fans, you know, it's cheaper. You know, the events back then, I think, were still $24.95. The In Your House shows, they charge $14.95 for. And so that was kind of the big selling point. And I have a lot of memories of In Your House. I have a lot of fond memories, actually, of being a fan back then, once I got over the whole Allied Powers thing. And I said, suck it up, right? You still enjoy this, right? Suck it up and enjoy it. So when the In Your House shows came along, I had a lot of memories of that. Obviously, I remember the first show where they gave a house away. I can't remember if I sent my own entry in. I don't think I did. I don't know why I didn't, but I don't believe I did. And they gave away a vacation home in Florida on that very first pay-per-view to an 11-year-old kid. Matt Pompaselli, he was the winner. And then as soon as his family got the keys to the house, like a week later or whatever, they started looking to sell it. They flipped it for $175,000 to help pay for the kids' college education. So after SummerSlam that year, in 1997, so now we're fast-forwarding 2 years, they made a pretty radical change. It really changed the whole concept of In Your House. Again, In Your House was less than 3 hours, lower price, entice more people to come in. September of 1997, they have an event coming up called Ground Zero. And they made this big change where from now on, all of the shows were going to be 3 hours. It was going to be no difference in length. They were all going to be 3 hours long. And the price would go up. So you were going to pay full price for these In Your House shows, which, you know, in a way kind of killed the whole concept as it was originally conceived. And you would think by doing that, it was a risk. Surprisingly, it was a risk that paid off because you would think, well, they're going to raise the price. Fewer people are going to buy the shows. In fact, the opposite happened, and more people bought the shows at the higher price, which meant the company brought in a ton of money that they didn't have coming in before. And if you think back to what was going on during that period, if you remember, one of the reasons that the whole fiasco with Bret Hart happened in 97, he had signed a 20-year contract the year before with Vince McMahon. Well, Vince McMahon came to him probably in the summer of 97 and said, listen, I'm going to breach your contract because I can't afford to pay you on this contract. He went to Bret, he said, listen, maybe if we backload it, you know, Bret didn't want to hear it. Vince said, well, if you're not willing to work with me on this, I can't pay you. I'm going to breach your contract. I give you permission. You can go negotiate with Ted Turner. Go negotiate with Eric Bischoff and WCW. And so he did. But then they raised pay-per-view prices, and all of a sudden, the numbers started to come back in. He's like, huh. So he goes to Bret a few weeks later, a month later, whatever it was, probably September, late September 97. He said, hey, listen, I could afford now. I could afford to pay you on your contract. By then, it was too late. Bret had already negotiated with WCW, and he had already reached a deal. It was over. It was a done deal. So just in that span of a few weeks, history could have been very, very different. You know, if he would have gotten to Bret in time, and Bret said, oh, great, okay, sure, I want to stay. But by then, it was too late, so... That's kind of how In Your House plays into the whole fiasco. And ultimately, I think it led to some little event that happened that year in November. I can't remember. But there were 27 In Your House shows. The original poster for Backlash in 1999 had it as Backlash In Your House. And all these years, I'd been of the impression that Backlash in 99 was the final In Your House show. In fact, technically it was not. 2 weeks before that pay-per-view, they scrubbed all mentions of In Your House. If you look at the final artwork for the poster and everything, if you go back on the network and you bring up the pay-per-view, at no point do you hear the words In Your House mentioned. So technically, that St. Valentine's Day Massacre show in February of 99, that is the final In Your House. So 27 of these events they have, in the archives. And, of course, that was the Austin McMahon cage match. So kind of an appropriate end to the legacy of In Your House. So in this countdown that I've put together here, I did not consider that Backlash show because it doesn't really count. If I had, I might have included Austin and Rock in the main event. I actually really like that match. I think that it's better than their WrestleMania 15 match. But in honor of the 25th anniversary of the show, and NXT is resurrecting the In Your House name for their TakeOver show this Sunday on pay-per-view. So In Your House, all of a sudden, at least for the next week, is in vogue again. I just thought, you know, for the 25th anniversary and everything, it could be fun just to put together a little countdown of my favorite In Your House matches and what I believe to be the top 10 best In Your House matches in the history of that pay-per-view. And there were quite a few of them, actually. There were actually a lot of good matches on that pay-per-view over the years. Now, when I put my list together, yeah, there are certain matches I didn't even have to think. I just wrote them down. I'd say that was probably 11 or 12. Then I went back to see if I may have missed anything, and I added three more on. So I think the final list I had put together was about 15 matches. Narrowed that down to 10, and what you are going to hear about here is my, again, this is my list. These are my favorite matches. These are the ones that I believe to be the best matches, the ones that you should When you have time, go on the network, bring them up, watch them. I think you'd enjoy them. I think your list is probably going to look a little bit different than mine. And if it does, go down below in the comments section and let me know. Let me know what you think of not just this list, but if you have your own list. If you think there's a match I missed that should have been on the list, let me know. That's what the comments section is for. Two names that you are going to see a lot in this countdown, probably to the surprise of no one, Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels. The In Your House event came about right in that New Generation era when they were building around Bret Hart. They were building around Shawn Michaels, or starting to. The era of Hogan and Savage was over. Those guys were gone. They had left. And so, naturally, you're going to see their names a lot because they're two of the best, obviously, in the history of the company. But it was right in that era when they were really coming up. They were really building around them. It was the Bret Shawn era of WWE. I've always said I thought of Bret Hart as Mr. SummerSlam. Shawn Michaels is known as Mr. WrestleMania because of all the classic WrestleMania matches. When I look at the list as I have constructed it, they sort of split the crown between the two of them. If anybody has the edge, though, it's Shawn Michaels. I think Shawn Michaels gets the slight edge in terms of best in your house matches. But we'll start in order from 10 on down to 1, 1 being what I think is the best match in your house history. Number 10, Ground Zero, In Your House, that first In Your House where the price went up in 97. Shawn Michaels against The Undertaker. These two guys have had some classic matches over the years. You may have seen them. You may have heard about them. And this was, I believe, this was the very first televised. They may have had house show matches. But you got to remember, Undertaker had been in the company since 1990. Right? The end of 90, beginning of 91. Shawn Michaels had been there for a few years prior to that. He was a tag team wrestler since probably 88. But they had never crossed paths before in a program or a storyline on television. And so they never had a match together. And so this was promoted as, for the first time ever, Shawn Michaels one-on-one, again, outside of maybe a few house show matches over the years, one-on-one for the first time on TV against The Undertaker. And it was hard to believe. Like, these guys have been around even at that point. I mean, let alone now. But even then, those guys have been around for years. And it was kind of surprising. Like, wow, this is the first time that they're, you know, matching these two up. The backstory, of course, was that at SummerSlam the month before, Undertaker had defended the WWF title against Bret Hart. Shawn Michaels, who had a very interesting 1997, you know, he was the champion, and then he had to give up the title because he lost his smile, and people were wondering how legitimate is the knee injury. But, oh, his career may be over. This could be a potentially career-ending knee injury. This could be the end of Shawn Michaels. And then, you know, 3 months later, 4 months later, not only was he back, but he looked as good as ever. He had a tag team title run with Steve Austin. Then he had a hair-pulling fight, a little cat fight in the back one night with Bret Hart. And he cried, unsafe work environment, and he went home. And there's always been stories over the years. He wanted out of his contract. He wanted to go to WCW and join his buddies. He had a meeting with Vince McMahon. He brought his father with him. He brought Mr. Hickenbottom with him to a meeting in one story. That's floated over the years. Met with Vince, tried to get out of his contract. Vince said, I ain't letting you out of your contract. He still had 4 years, I think 4 years left on his deal. He would have sat him at home. He was not going to let Shawn Michaels walk into WCW. So SummerSlam was his grand return as a special guest referee. That was the great role for Shawn Michaels at SummerSlam back in 97. And he was the referee for the Bret Hart Undertaker match for the WWF Championship. And at the end, there was an errant chair shot. He hit the Undertaker by accident. He cost him the title. And now the Undertaker was pissed. Undertaker had a beef all of a sudden with Shawn Michaels. Shawn had turned heel pretty much on TV after that. And so that's what led to this match here. Plus, he formed, you know, this alliance with Triple H in China. That's how DX was formed. There were so many ref bumps in this match, I lost count. I mean, from I think before the bell even rang, there were multiple referee bumps. This was just, like I said, Undertaker was really pissed off at Shawn Michaels. You can believe that he was pissed off at this guy. And they're brawling all over the place. The match hasn't even started yet. Michaels is trying to escape. He's trying to get away. He's going up the ramp. he tries to go, or he goes through the, remember the In Your House sets? They had like an actual house. It was a door. He tried to go through the door. Undertaker, this is one of my favorite spots of this match. They're up on the stage, or like the top of the ramp, and Undertaker just, he punches him. And Michaels takes this over-exaggerated, ridiculous bump backwards, where he basically rolls all the way down the ramp. Very exaggerated, but I always laugh my ass off when I watch it. It was kind of shades of the match with Hogan many years later at SummerSlam, but I don't know. I always thought that was a great spot. But this the match itself went about 15 minutes. 10 minutes of this was before the bell. So really from start to finish, this whole thing was probably half an hour. 15 minutes of which was part of the actual match. And a lot of it just consisted of Undertaker just beating the piss out of Shawn Michaels. I mean, Michaels, you know, he got some offense in, but a lot of this was just Undertaker getting out all that pent-up rage and all that frustration over Michaels costing him the title and just, you know, being a jerk-off. And it was him, you know, beating the hell out of Shawn. This was really more of a wild brawl, I'd say, than a wrestling match. It's just a chaotic, crazy, wild brawl. And if you had told me, especially 2020 me, maybe not 1997 me, although even in 1997, you know, cheap DQ finishes and overbooking and stuff was a turnoff, you know, to me even then as a fan. But if you would have told me coming into this, you go, there's going to be half a dozen ref bumps and there's going to be tons of interference and there's going to be no finish, right? They basically threw the match out. There was really no decided winner in the match. If you would have told me that this match was going to be full of all that, I would have said, you know, what is TNA? Because TNA went through a period of time with like Jeff Jarrett main events where that's all they did. They overbooked the shit out of all of those TNA main events. Some of them were good, most of them weren't. But I would have told you it sounded like an overbooked mess. And the reality is, it was. It was an overbooked mess, but it was a fun overbooked mess. I love this match. This right here, this is the match really between these two. The first match that does not get talked about a lot. For obvious reasons, it gets overshadowed by Hell in a Cell. It gets overshadowed, you know, even the casket match because Shawn got hurt. People talk about that. They talk about the WrestleMania matches. And rightfully so, because those are fantastic matches. But this one, I think, unfairly gets overlooked because it really is a lot of fun. It really is great. I loved all of this. I loved what they did here. And I had to work this into my top 10 because it doesn't get enough love, and it should. So you hear about all the other ones. Make time to watch this one. I think you'll enjoy it. So that brings us to number 9 in the top 10, which is Stone Cold Steve Austin taking on Savio Vega. Stone Cold and Savio Vega in a Caribbean strap match at In Your House, Beware of Dog. I have to specify here, Beware of Dog 2. There were two Beware of Dog shows. They wrestled on both of them. I'll tell you why in a second, but this was night 2. And Austin and Vega had a little feud in early 96. They had a match at WrestleMania. It wasn't great. And it continued on into the month of May. Beware of Dog was an In Your House show that they were having in South Carolina. And I don't remember if it was just a really bad rainstorm, if it was a tornado. I don't know what kind of storm it was, but it was a really bad storm. A lot of rain and thunder, I think, and lightning. And there was a power outage. During the pay-per-view, there was a massive power outage. I remember this night very, very well. I was not home watching the pay-per-view, which I was very upset about. I don't remember where we were. And it was kind of like racing home to watch the pay-per-view, which I was going to maybe get there in the middle of the show. I remember getting home, and the pay-per-view had already been ordered, and I put the TV on, and I was greeted by a blue screen. Not like the blue screen I get on my laptop pretty much every day. Thank you, Windows. But I was greeted by a blue screen. And I thought to myself, what the hell's going on here? No audio. Nothing. Just a blue screen. I thought there was a problem with my cable company. I was all pissed off. I bought this pay-per-view. I have a blue screen. So I sat there, you know, for a while. I was on the phone with the cable company. They were very busy. Probably had a lot of people calling. And eventually, the feed just came back on. The feed reappeared. Not the fiend. The feed reappeared. And there's Vince McMahon apologizing, explaining what had happened. Well, what had happened is the pay-per-view opened just fine. There was a match between, I think it was Triple H and Wildman Mark Marrow. And then there was a backstage promo, I think. And then as Stone Cold was coming to the ring for his match with Vega, or maybe Vega was coming to the ring for the match with Austin, the feed went out. I watched the tape back later, and that's where the feed cut off, at least for me it did. And it didn't come back on until it was just in time for the main event. So the whole mid-card, we all missed it because the feed got knocked out. But the show continued in the building. So they wrestled in the dark. If they had any lights, it was very minimal. They wrestled in the dark. The show went on, right? That's the mantra with WWE. The show must go on. So Austin and Vega, they did have their strap match on night one. And the outcome really wasn't any different. I believe Vega won. But they ended up redoing the match. What happened is the pay-per-view replay spot was typically the Tuesday after the pay-per-view. They would always hype it up. If you missed the show, you could watch the replay Tuesday night at 8 p.m. So instead of doing the replay, they took that and they aired the matches that people didn't see. They redid them. They couldn't show them from the other night because it was in the dark. So they just redid them. They had a Superstars taping in a different city, a different part of South Carolina. So it was like a different set, different aisle way. And they just redid the matches. And one of the matches they redid here was the strap match between Austin and Vega. And these two guys went out there for over 20 minutes. And I'm not the biggest fan of the way they do strap matches in WWE. You got to touch the corners in succession. If it gets interrupted, you got to start all over again. It's kind of goofy. And you're also very limited, right? Because you're attached to this strap and you're kind of limited in what you can do and your movements and everything. These guys went out there for over 20 minutes and had a kick-ass match. This is a great match that, again, really doesn't get talked about. It's very much overlooked, I think, by a lot of people. And I'm willing to bet there's a lot of people watching this right now, maybe newer fans who are like, beware of what? What are you talking about? It's on the network. You know, both shows, part one, part two, they're both on the network. If you watch one match from that Beware of Dog show, I mean, don't bother with Sean and Bulldog because they've had better matches. Make it this one. Austin and Vega strap match. And what they did on Raw the night before, they kind of upped the ante. And Ted DiBiase, he was managing Austin at the time. He said, look, I believe in this guy so much that if Austin doesn't win this match, I'm gone. I will leave WWE, or you know, WWF at the time. Because he was leaving anyway. DiBiase ended up going to WCW, and he was managing the Steiner brothers. Eventually, he joined the NWO. Everybody joined the NWO. The janitor joined the NWO. You know, the toll booth clerk joined the NWO. I'm pretty sure, I mean, I was a young kid, but I'm pretty sure I joined the NWO at some point. You probably joined the NWO. Everybody joined the NWO. So that was the stipulation that they added to this match. And the finish was kind of clever. Austin was dragging him behind him, touching the corner. Well, he didn't realize that as he was going from corner to corner, Vega was also touching the turnbuckles. And so they did this big dramatic finish where Austin is reaching for the turnbuckle and Vega, it's like a tug of war with the leather strap, which, by the way, they beat the hell out of each other with that leather strap. But they're pulling and they're pulling, and finally Austin pulls so hard that Vega comes vaulting into the corner. He touches the buckle and Savio wins the match. DiBiase is gone. They even played over the PA system that na 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 hey hey goodbye song. And off he went. That was the end of his career in WWE. And, you know, Austin was, and I think the other stipulation also was that if Vega lost, he would have to be DiBiase's chauffeur. So he would have to be his chauffeur, I don't know, for a night or just permanently. But anyway, so Vega won, so he didn't have to worry about that. Austin was very happy to get rid of DiBiase. He even talked about it in his book, The Stone Cold Truth, that came out many years ago. He said when he had DiBiase as his manager, he was never allowed to talk, or he would say a few words and that was it. DiBiase did all the talking for him. He was his mouthpiece. So when he left, he was very happy to kind of get rid of him. It was almost like just getting this huge weight lifted off his shoulders. And I don't know, I mean, call me crazy, but I think that Stone Cold guy turned out to be pretty decent on the microphone. He turned out to be all right. So again, the strap match, Beware of Dog Part 2. Very, very good match. Very underrated. That brings us to number 8 in the countdown. Bret the Hitman Hart. There's that name again. Bret Hart, one-on-one against the British Bulldog. Davey Boy Smith, In Your House, Seasons Beatings, December of 1995. Bulldog had a very plodding, very boring, god-awful match with Diesel at the October 95 In Your House show. This match was so bad, Vince McMahon supposedly, when the show went off the air, threw his headset down in disgust. He might have actually just shouted out the word terrible, and he stormed off. So even he knew that it was, you know, a giant turd, pretty much. You know, and both guys were capable of a lot more. Diesel, the next month, went on to have one of the best matches of his career at Survivor Series against Bret Hart. And the Bulldog went on 2 months later to have one of the great matches of his WWE career against who? Bret Hart. There's a common denominator. I mean, Bulldog was talented. I'm not saying he wasn't, but there's a common denominator here in terms of who these guys were working with. And so they had had their classic match in Wembley, you know, 4 years earlier, or three years earlier, SummerSlam 92, babyface against babyface. Here we go again, only this time Bulldog was the heel. Otherwise, it was the same dynamic. You have Bret one-on-one against his brother-in-law, his sister, Davey's wife, Diana. She was there, just like she was at Wembley. Diana was there at ringside. They kept doing a split screen and cutting to see her very stone-faced reaction, which really never changed. So that was kind of the drama that they played up with this match. Bret at one point got bumped off the ring steps. He got whipped into the ring steps, and he bladed. Especially now, you go back and watch it. You can kind of see where he does it. But I think at the time, he played it off like it was legitimate, just like he did at WrestleMania against Piper. That's why he didn't get in trouble. Ric Flair got in trouble. Ric Flair, in his book, he said, he got fined some ridiculous amount of money by Vince McMahon for blading at WrestleMania 8. How come Bret didn't get in trouble? Because Bret was good about hiding it and pretending, oh no, it was an accident. He was a lot more subtle about it than Ric Flair. I mean, Ric Flair bleeds. If Ric Flair takes a breath, when he takes a deep breath and he inhales in the morning, blood comes pouring down his face. Everybody expects that he's going to bleed. You can't hide that. Bret was very good about that. So that's kind of what happened here. This is a time when blood was not seen on WWF television. It really was not permitted. And so this was a big deal to see Bret come up. There's a puddle of blood on the floor outside. The cut was actually really small. As the match went on, it wasn't like he was wearing the Crimson Mask or anything. But that blood really added a lot of drama to the match. And the second half of the match is a lot better than the first half. Bulldog at one point took a bump out of the corner. I had gone back and watched it. I forgot about this, but this made me laugh. Late in the match, there's a spot where he gets whipped into the corner, and he does this flip where he's going to flip into the corner and his body is basically going to bounce off the buckles out of the corner. Well, he bounces. The problem is he doesn't rotate all the way over. He landed right on top of his head. So he bumped and boom, right down on top of his skull. I'm sure that didn't feel too good. There's also a great Chris Jericho story. I don't know how many of you remember. Many years ago, this probably would have been 2013, I believe. Pretty sure it was 2013. They did Bret Hart Appreciation Night. I think they were in Calgary. So when Raw went off the air, and they put the footage on YouTube, you know, after. But they just had Bret come out. Bret was there that night. And they had Pat Patterson came out, Chris Jericho came out, Jerry Lawler was in the ring to kind of honor him, and Vince McMahon, Shawn Michaels, they all came out just to pay tribute to Bret, this like half hour little ceremony. So Chris Jericho was there, and Chris Jericho told a story. He said, you know, this is one of the things that kind of kept me going when I was younger in my career and made me think, you know what, I can really do this. And there was a 50th anniversary show or party, some kind of event for Stu Hart. I think it was like a 50th anniversary reunion thing for Stampede Wrestling. 2 days before this In Your House show, in December of 95, was this 50th anniversary deal. And Bret was actually wrestling the Bulldog in the main event. So they're lucky nobody got hurt, because they had a pay-per-view match 2 days later. But Jericho was there. He was not on the card. He was not used, but he was backstage. And he tells the story. Bret's back there. He's getting ready for his match with Davey. And he's just talking out loud about their pay-per-view match in Hershey in 2 days. He goes, you know, I'm having trouble coming up with a finish. I don't want to use the sharpshooter. I want to use something other than the sharpshooter to win my match. Does anybody have any ideas? And Jericho spoke up. He might have been the only one. And Jericho spoke up, and he had worked in Mexico. And he had seen a wrestler named Negro Casas use a move called La Magistral Cradle, which, of course, we've seen used in a bunch of matches over the years. And Brett, I guess, was not familiar with the move. So Brett said, can you show me? He wanted him to demonstrate the move. And Jericho said, well, Sean Waltman, the 1-2-3 kid, he was also there that night. So I guess he and Waltman, they showed Brett how to do a La Magistral Cradle. And that was it. That was all that was said. So Jericho's at home. A couple days later, he's watching the pay-per-view. And wouldn't you know, for the finish, there's Bret Hart pinning Davey Boy Smith with a La Magistral Cradle. And he couldn't believe it. He was blown away. He looked at that and he said, here's this guy. He's the world champion, right? He's like the biggest star in the business, you know, in this country at the time. I mean, you could argue that, but certainly in the company, right? He was the champion. Bret was the man. And, you know, here he is taking a suggestion from some young nobody. I mean, Jericho was still, you know, an unknown really at the time. And so Jericho never forgot that. And so he told that story. So as far as the finish, because I have never seen Brett use that move before, and I have never seen Brett use it again. Maybe he did. Maybe he used it in a WCW match or something. That's the only time I could think of, like in a big pay-per-view match, where I saw Bret Hart use a La Magistral Cradle. And it kind of came out of nowhere. I kind of feel like it would have been nicer, like it would have been better for him to play off the finish from 92, you know, when they did that cradle spot and Davey hooked the legs forward and that's how he pinned Brett. I almost feel like it would have been better maybe for them to kind of do that spot, but this time Brett reverses it and gets the win, but yeah, whatever. It was something different. I liked it. I liked the match a lot. It is a classic match. Some people think it's better than the SummerSlam match at Wembley. I'm tell you what, I might be in the same camp. I think having watched this match, I haven't seen the Wembley match in a long time. I'd have to go back and watch it. Obviously, the Wembley match is more epic. Pay-per-view main event. Wembley Stadium outdoors, 80,000 people. Bulldog in his home country. The place comes unglued. Big title change. You can't replicate that dynamic. In terms of, like, epicness, clearly the SummerSlam match was a bigger match, but I think this might have been the better actual wrestling match, you know, and more dramatic with the blood and everything, so it's a very good match. We get to number 7, In Your House, Final Four, in February of 1997. This goes back to that time period where Shawn Michaels, he lost his smile. I don't know where it went. I don't know where it's hiding. He lost his smile. He has a knee injury. It's a potentially career-ending knee injury. He's got to forfeit the championship. Now, mind you, this all happens 3 days before a pay-per-view that was going to have a Final Four match, first ever Fatal Four Way. This was an elimination match to determine who would challenge for the championship, I assume, at WrestleMania. And there's always been talk that Shawn was going to drop the title that night on that Thursday Raw show that they did to Psycho Sid. I don't know if that's true or not, if they were going to do the title change or not. I believe they were. But he has the knee injury. And he loses his smile. He's got to go find it. It's like, you know, trying to... He's going to be a detective. He's going to be a gumshoe. He's going to go search for his smile. So this is 3 days before the event. And now the championship is vacant. And that changes everything. So the Fatal 4-Way is now, or the Final Four, is now for the title. It's no longer for a title opportunity, it's now for the championship. And they add Royal Rumble elimination rules. So you can eliminate somebody by pinfall, you can eliminate somebody by submission, but you could also eliminate them by dumping them out over the top rope and having both feet touch the floor. So that's the special rule that they added to the match. And everybody was eliminated over the top rope. Nobody got pinned. Nobody gave up. Everybody who was eliminated except Brett in that match went out over the top rope. This was not a technical masterpiece. I will tell you that. There are points in the match where, for example, Vader is outside with Austin or even Brett, but especially like with Austin, and they look lost, like they don't know what to do next. Now, part of this is the fact that Vader is hurt. Very early in the match, they're outside brawling. Vader is coming at the Undertaker, who's up by the post, and he's coming at him with a chair. Undertaker kicks the chair back into Vader's face, and Vader comes up bloody. The chair went back into his face, and it busted his eye open, and it was a gnarly injury. I mean, there was blood everywhere. I mean, finally, late in the match, he took the freaking mask off. I don't know why he kept it on for so long, but they would, like, zoom in on it. Everything was just full of blood. It was really nasty, and this happened in the first probably 5 minutes of the match, of what was, you know, a pretty long match, probably a 25-minute match, and he lasted almost until the very end. So Vader was probably out of it, could barely see, had blood in his eye, but there were times where these guys just, they were winging it. They were lost. They didn't know what to do, what the next spot was. This was not a technical masterpiece. But it didn't have to be. I mean, that's not what this was supposed to be. This felt like a war. This was a war between all four of these men. It was Texas Tornado rules, so there's no tagging in and out or any of that nonsense. It's just a giant brawl, pretty much, with no rules, no disqualifications, no countouts. This was not a match that was about finesse. This was not a match that was about technical ability. These were four guys going to war to become the champion. That's what this was. And like I said, Vader was a bloody mess. Austin went out first. There's been a lot of like rumors and urban legends over the years. Oh, he wasn't supposed to go out. He hurt his knee. No, he didn't. Everything as far as that goes, Austin was never supposed to win the title. You know, plus if you hurt his knee, I mean, he came back out later in the match. You know, he came back out. Vader got eliminated. Austin's out there. He's trying to get in the ring. Referees are holding him back. And Bret ends up clotheslining The Undertaker out over the top rope, and Bret Hart wins his fourth WWF title in a rather uneventful way. You know, clotheslining him out over the top, but whatever. This was really fun. This was just a battle. That's the best way I can describe it. Four of the very best at the time. Austin was still on the rise. Vader had kind of been bungled. You know, they could have had a monster heel champion the summer before, and they didn't go with him for whatever reason. Shawn Michaels. So, as a match, I loved it. Pure chaos. But if you're looking for a match that is you know, technically sound, this is not the match for you. Of course, next night on Raw, Bret lost the championship to Sid. Bret went on to wrestle Steve Austin on the undercard at WrestleMania. And they had a pretty good match. They had a pretty good match. Number six, Shawn Michaels against Big Daddy Cool Diesel, Good Friends, Better Enemies in Your House, April 1996. This was a month after Bret won the title. What led to this? Well, Diesel turned on Shawn Michaels 2 weeks before WrestleMania. They had a tag team match at Madison Square Garden, and Diesel took a chair, and he hit Shawn in the back with it. He turned on his friend. Shawn goes on to WrestleMania. He wins the championship from Bret Hart. Diesel loses. He's already given his notice. He's already on his way to WCW. But they're going to have him do the honors on the way out. He loses to The Undertaker at WrestleMania. Kind of makes you wonder if he wasn't going to WCW. Might Diesel have beaten The Undertaker at WrestleMania? Then there would be no streak. We'll never know. So Diesel loses. But even though he lost, he had turned on Shawn. And so they had an issue. And so he was the one who got the next title shot. Diesel got the next title shot at the In Your House show. And they, you know, obviously they wanted him to put over Shawn. He's leaving. We'll do the whole David and Goliath thing, and it'll be a good fight for Shawn to have, where he'll get to go out there. There'll be weapons and stuff. It's a no-holds-barred match. We'll make him look tough. Diesel had promised a surprise for Vince McMahon coming into the show. He's like, I got a little something for you. And nobody knew what that meant. Nobody knew what that was. He came out, he took his jacket off, he threw it at Vince at the announce desk. His big surprise, his big gift for Vince, turned out to be a powerbomb to his boy. He powerbombed Shawn Michaels through the announce desk. That was the big spot. The other spot was the Mad Dog Vachon spot, where Mad Dog Vachon was in the crowd. Legend, right? Legendary figure. He's in the Hall of Fame, I believe. He's in the Hall of Fame. And he had lost his leg in an automobile accident many years earlier. So he had a fake leg. He had a prosthetic leg. Diesel walks over to where he is sitting. He's right. He's like in the front row, right in the corner of the aisleway. And Diesel just casually strolls over and he grabs the barricade. He throws the barricade. So now the barricade is open. He grabs Vachon. He puts him gently down on the ground and he yanks his leg out. He pulls off his leg. That's a heel move. That's a heel move. Pulls off his leg. This is years before I think they did the same thing with Zach Gowen on SmackDown, I think with Piper. This was many years later. Sean and Diesel did it first, and he tried to use it as a weapon. Sean low-blowed him. Sean took the leg. He called his shot like Babe Ruth. He hit Diesel with it. Super kick, 1-2-3. Shawn Michaels wins. This is the greatest Kevin Nash match ever. In terms of, and the two people that Nash had his best matches with, again, to no surprise, Shawn Michaels and Bret Hart. This was a better match. I enjoyed this more than I did their Survivor Series 95 match with Bret and Diesel. This was the best of his career. Bar none, hands down, there's no better Kevin Nash match, in my opinion, than this. And so for that reason alone, you should go check that out. Good friends, better enemies. All right, now we're in the bottom five here, or I guess top five, depending on how you look at it. We're up to number five. Shawn Michaels and Jeff Jarrett, In Your House, which was technically titled In Your House, The Lumberjacks. That's the name they gave it, I think, once it hit home video. July of 1995. Speaking of best matches, Shawn had Kevin Nash's best match. He also had Jeff Jarrett's best match in WWE. The best match Jarrett ever had in this company was at this In Your House show with Shawn Michaels. Never had as good of a match as this. This came about, there was a little dust up on Raw in the weeks leading up to the show. Shawn Michaels, I think, was on commentary one night. And Jeff Jarrett was wrestling Savio Vega. The roadie was there. I think the roadie shoved Vega into Shawn. It was one of these, like, stupid little things that just, not as stupid as, Chris Jericho spilling coffee on Kane, or Edge wrestling Booker T over a Japanese shampoo commercial at WrestleMania. Not that level of dumb, but, minor little dust up here, and that led to issues between them. That was a big night. This In Your House show was a big night for Jarrett. He had his live performance of With My Baby Tonight, which we later found out was sung by the roadie. But we didn't find that out until a long time later. And then later that night, he was going to wrestle Shawn Michaels and defend his championship, and so he did. And this was just a great professional wrestling match. And it was not a case where, Shawn, carried him. No, Jarrett was every bit as good as Shawn. Now, Jarrett held his own. It was just this classic kind of old school, put down the baby face. Michaels makes his big heroic comeback. Then at the end of the match, there's this little mix-up where Road Dogg reaches in, thinks he's tripping Jarrett, but it's actually Shawn. He wasn't paying attention. Super kick, 1-2-3. Shawn wins his third Intercontinental title. Jarrett and the roadie. Actually, the real interesting stuff came after the match, because what was supposed to happen is after the match, in the ring, Jarrett and Rhodey were going to have their breakup. This was going to lead to a storyline and probably a match at SummerSlam between Jarrett and the Rhodey, and it never happened. They didn't even shoot the angle, even though they had rehearsed it earlier that day. And instead, they left, they went to the back, and they quit. They walked out. They didn't even wait for the show to end. Probably Rhodey out of loyalty to Jeff. Jeff had issues with the company, and so they both bailed. They both split. They hightailed it. And then it was weeks of conversations and negotiations with Jarrett and the company. He did come back in December, but he was only back for maybe 2 months, and then he left again, and then he went to WCW. So, reason being, I think, if I remember, it was a case of Jarrett just feeling that the split was coming too soon. You're killing me too soon, You're going to expose me as being a fraud singer. You took the title from me. You're splitting me up with Brian, right, with Road Dogg. And he thought they were, not intentionally, but he thought they were sabotaging him. Like, what are you doing to me? We're doing this split too soon. Like, we got a good thing going here. What are you doing? And so he's like, let's go. We're walking out. So they never shot the angle that was originally intended, even after they did a dry run for it earlier that day. But this, of course, set up the ladder match at SummerSlam between Shawn and Sid. It was or Shawn and Razor. It was going to be Shawn and Sid one-on-one. They looked at the card for SummerSlam that year and said, this thing is a stinker. This card sucks. We need to have some kind of special attraction that's going to get people to want to buy this show. I still remember that SummerSlam. Stridex Pimple Pads presents SummerSlam. I remember that. Number four, Shawn Michaels against Mankind. In Your House Mind Games from Philadelphia, September 1996. Mankind had two pay-per-view wins over The Undertaker, which was unheard of. Coming into this show, he had earned himself the right to challenge for the championship. And they had protected his finish. They had protected that mandible claw finish a lot, very well, going into this match. Foley, in his book, says that this was where he was at his best. He was in the best physical shape of his career heading into that Mind Games match against Shawn Michaels. It was like Svelte Mick Foley. If you look at him in 96 compared to maybe how he looked in 98, 99. And kind of like the Diesel match, this was a chance for them to give Shawn Michaels a harder edge. They're in Philadelphia. You've got people chanting ECW the entire show. In fact, I believe there were ECW stars. This was the pay-per-view where they were in the audience at the beginning of the show. And there was a little dust-up with, I think, if it was Tommy Dreamer or Taz or whatever, some of the ECW guys and like Bradshaw in the opening match. So they wanted to give Shawn a harder edge here. You have these kind of bloodthirsty fans. There's no blood, but you know, they had a match that this crowd ate up. This crowd loved it. They enjoyed this match, the high spots in this match, going through tables and stuff. They worked a temper tantrum spot into the match. So at SummerSlam the month before, Shawn wrestled Vader. There was a famous spot or infamous spot where Shawn comes off the top rope. Vader is supposed to move. He doesn't move. Shawn lands on his feet, and right there, live on camera, live in the middle of this pay-per-view, he looks down at Leon, he looks down at Vader, and just shouts, "Move!" And then he stomped on his face so hard. What a little prick. What a little prick this guy was. It's too bad Vader didn't beat the fuck out of him when they got to the back. I would have taught him a lesson. All I hear about Vader is, oh, he was such a teddy bear. Vader was like crying after the fact, because he was upset that he messed up, and he was also worried, you know, he knew the influence that Shawn had, and he was worried that it could negatively impact his career. Well, guess what? That's exactly what happened, because then he was going to win the title at Survivor Series, and that changed to Sid. That was it. Vader was done. He was dead at that point. They had two opportunities in 96 to put the title on him and push him as this big monster heel champion. SummerSlam. And they could have done it again at Madison Square Garden at Survivor Series. And when they didn't, that was it. That was it. There was really no coming back at that point for Vader. You know, he had that bloody performance in the Final Four a few months later. After that, what did he do? What did he do for the remainder of his WWE career? The next year that he was there, year and a half, what did he do? He didn't do anything. He challenged The Undertaker for the title. So what? He was never the same after that. But the tantrum spot, they worked a fake tantrum into the match because they wanted to work the dirt sheets and the newsletters. They wanted to work kind of like the smarks into thinking, uh-oh, Shawn's going off again, but it was all planned. I think it was Foley's idea. He's like, listen, we're going to do a spot where I kind of mess up a move, and then you yell at me, and you hit me and come at me. That was all worked. That was all pre-planned between them beforehand. For the few fans at that time who would have known what the significance of that even was. So they had a disqualification finish to this match, which, not an ideal finish. Vader was actually supposed to run in. He was, I think, a little late. Shawn had Mankind pinned. He had to get up before Vader even hit the ring. He kind of went after Vader. Referee called for the DQ, and it was just total pandemonium at this point. Sid ran down. He fought off Vader. Paul Bearer hit Shawn from behind in the head with the urn. Mankind put him in the claw, gave the sign, lift the lid up on the casket that was at ringside. Paul Bearer lifts the lid up, and out pops The Undertaker. Paul Bearer's reaction, his shriek, was just priceless. And Philadelphia lit up like you have never seen a crowd light up before. This crowd went nuts. They lost their minds when The Undertaker came out of that casket. He grabbed Mankind, he goozled him by the throat, threw him out of the ring. you know, look, cheap disqualification finish, but the post-match stuff was pure chaos. And the match was excellent. You know, again, even the post-match stuff I thought was a lot of fun. So Shawn and Mankind, one of the greatest in-your-house matches of all time, and I have it at number four on my list, which leads us to number three. We have three more left here. Over the Edge, 1998, May of 1998, not that Over the Edge. The first one from May of 98, another Foley match. So Foley appears yet again. This time it's as his alter ego, Dude Love, one-on-one against Stone Cold Steve Austin for the WWF title. I love this match. I've talked about the match on the podcast before. Many years ago, I do recall there being a professor. I don't remember where he was teaching. It might have been up in Boston or something, some college or university. And I think it was a media course. I don't know if it was a pro wrestling course or a media course where they talked about pro wrestling. I remember him using this match as an example. Like, it was on the syllabus as an example, talking about pro wrestling and what makes it so great. So this is a match that they taught in a college course. That's how great this match was. When I think about this match is everything fun about the Attitude Era, all rolled up into one. Was it overbooked? You bet. Yes, it was. The odds were stacked against Austin. Vince McMahon, Pat Patterson was there as the guest ring announcer. He was hilarious. Gerald Briscoe was the guest timekeeper. Vince McMahon, in his very tight sleeveless shirt, was the referee. And Stone Cold was defending the title against the corporate version of, you know, Dude Love. Like, he had his teeth in and everything. And so it's like, how is Austin going to overcome this? Well, The Undertaker came out. He was going to be in Austin's corner. He volunteered. He was going to be ringside to watch Stone Cold, make sure things didn't get out of hand. And they had what I thought was a very enjoyable match. Foley, of course, you know, he took some crazy bumps. The set for the show, they had these like burned out cars and everything in the aisleway. And he like backdropped Foley off one of them at one point onto the ground, onto the concrete, like crazy stuff. But it built to a finish where Foley had a chair and he was going to hit Austin. Austin was arguing with Vince McMahon, right? So Vince McMahon Austin had his back turned. He was arguing with Vince McMahon. And right as Vince puts up the double bird, he puts up the double bird to flip off Austin. Here comes Dude Love. Austin ducks out of the way. And when I tell you that Mick Foley pasted Vince McMahon in the head with this chair, I mean he pasted Vince McMahon in the head with this chair. He rattled his brains. It's no wonder that he is the way he is now. Although he's always been that way. He scrambled this guy's brains, and Vince crumpled. He fell to his knees, and he just crumpled to the mat. If I remember correctly, he hit him so hard that he had to go have emergency dental work done. He might have knocked out some of Vince's teeth. That's how hard he hit him with this chair. Kicks him in the gut, stunner, place is going nuts. No referee, because the referee's down. Here comes another referee. Pat Patterson yanks the referee out of the ring. Everyone's just beside themselves. Now they're angry. Undertaker, he grabs Patterson. He chokeslams him. He takes this great bump, too. Takes this great chokeslam bump through the announce desk. Briscoe tries to get in, count the fall. Undertaker drags him out of the ring. He chokeslams Briscoe. That was not such a great chokeslam, but the table broke. Table broke. I don't know how, but it broke. Austin kicks Foley in the dick and gives him a stunner. Grabs Vince's hand. Now, the whole stipulation was, this match will only end by my hand. That is what Vince McMahon said. Those were his words. By my hand only. Well, Austin took him up on that. He grabbed Vince. Vince's laying there dead. He took Vince's hand. One, two, three. Counted the fall. Place goes nuts. Austin has overcome the odds. Jim Ross was just fantastic on commentary. He called, you know, the toughest son of a bitch to overcome this. This was so great. And of course, Undertaker is eyeballing Austin. That was sort of the beginning seeds being planted for their feud that would lead eventually to SummerSlam. Overbooked, absolutely. A lot of stuff was back then. there was a lot of Attitude Era stuff that when you look back on it is kind of cringy, and it's not all great. This, though, is not an example of that. This was, when I think of that Attitude Era, this is the match I think of. This was such a fun match to watch. So now we get to the top two, which I don't know that this is really going to be much of a surprise as far as what they are. The only question is, what order are they in? And I have a feeling everybody's going to have a different opinion about this. Maybe not. We'll see. But my number two takes us back to the summer of 1997. The In Your House Canadian Stampede from the Calgary, or call it the Calgary Stampede. Some people call it that. From the Calgary Saddle Dome. That whole pay-per-view is one of the best WWF pay-per-views, top to bottom, of all time. Very short show. They only had, like, I don't know, four matches maybe. Mankind and Triple H opened the show. They had a very good match. Taka Michinoku, he outshined the great Sasuke, even though it was supposed to be a more of an exhibition for Sasuke. But here's Taka Michinoku flying all over the place, doing stuff that we hadn't seen in a WWF ring. We had seen stuff like that in the cruiserweight division in WCW, but really never in the WWF. Undertaker and Vader. Undertaker and Vader actually had a very good championship match. But it all built to this match here. It was a 10-man tag. It was Team Canada against Team USA. Stone Cold, well, let me tell you this first. Jim Ross has his Grillin' JR podcast many months ago. He confirmed what the original plan was, what the original lineup was for this match. It is not the match that actually happened. It's not the teams that we saw. Originally, it was going to be the Hart Foundation, which it was. Bret Hart, Owen Hart, British Bulldog, Jim Neidhart, and Brian Pillman. I can't believe all of them except Bret are gone. It still depresses the shit out of me when I think about that. But it was going to be the Hart Foundation against Stone Cold Steve Austin, Shawn Michaels, Psycho Sid, and the Legion of Doom. That's what the match was originally going to be. What we got was the Hart Foundation against Stone Cold Steve Austin, Ken Shamrock, Goldust, and LOD. So imagine, as great as this match was, imagine if you had, at that time, back in 97, at the peak of all of this angst and all of the issues between, and the Sunny Days comment and everything between Bret and Shawn. This was only weeks after they had their little hissy fit, their little hissy cat fight in the back where they pulled each other's hair out in the bathroom or whatever. And Shawn, and they got suspended or sent home that night, and Shawn went home. He didn't come back again for 2 months or whatever. But imagine if that Shawn Michaels, you planted him right in the middle of the Calgary Saddle Dome in this match, in there against the Hart family and against Bret Hart. Imagine Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels going at it in the ring in the middle of Calgary at this show with how hot that crowd was. There was one point early in the match where Bret and Austin were going at it, and Bret had Austin in the corner, and he's stomping the shit out of Steve Austin. And literally, the building is shaking. The hard camera is shaking. The build, even Lawler's, this building is shaking. Now imagine if that was Shawn Michaels in there with Bret Hart. Holy shit. I mean, the match as it was great. But when I think about what the lineup could have been, I mean, Sid, yeah, whatever. But, and I like Sid, but in this match, it would have been all about Bret and Shawn. That would have been incredible. I mean, think of the reaction that Shawn got when he walked out in Montreal in 2005. Now, again, that was post-Screwjob. But even back then in 97, in the middle of the year, you have to think that Shawn Michaels would have been public enemy number one walking into that building. So that would have been an even more incredible match. But just everything I love about pro wrestling. Pure emotion. They played up that USA-Canada feud. The fans bought into, I mean, they basically turned the two countries against each other in a way. It's basically what they did, right? The American fans would shit on the Canadians would shit on the Americans. It got a little too real there for a while, but I like that. And you really could believe, like, especially Austin and Bret, these guys hated each other. And they went in there and they just fought it out. The crowd is the star of this match. I think this match would have been fun probably anywhere. This match does not rise to the level of like legendary status that it does if it's not in that building that night. The crowd absolutely made this match. It was a spectacle. Owen Hart got some cheap roll-up win on Steve Austin to set up their match at SummerSlam, which Austin probably wishes they never had. But they had all the Hart family was there. The brothers got involved. This big brawl broke out when the match was over. Austin had, you know, he left. He came back with a chair like a crazy guy all by himself. No protection. He just gets in the ring with a ring full of Hart family members and goes after. I think he hit the anvil with a chair. The whole family swarms him. Then the whole family is invited up into the ring. Teddy Hart was there before he was a fuck-up. All the Hart family members come into the ring. Owen's got his kids again, which is very sad to see. But he, you know, his kids were there. His wife was there. They brought Stu into the ring. And they're all having one big Hart family celebration. It was one big Hart family celebration. But when those guys walked into the building, even for the entrances, when Pillman came out, he got a megastar reaction. When Jim Neidhart came out, he got a megastar reaction. When Davey came out, when Owen came out, and then they waited. They waited, and then they played Brett's music, and I swear to you, when they started Brett's music, I couldn't hear the opening chords. I didn't even know they started the music until it hit like that next, that main beat. And then out he came, and they were like gods. It's probably like it was with the Von Erichs in Texas back in the day. They were like, that night, they were gods. So much fun to watch that match. One of the greatest matches in company history. So you would think, well, if that's one of the greatest matches in company history, then what's number one? Well, I mean, it should be obvious, right? It should be obvious what number one is. Number one is what some people may say is the greatest match in company history. It's certainly one of them. Bad Blood, In Your House, October 1997, Shawn Michaels against The Undertaker. The first ever Hell in a Cell. Jim Cornette was on the creative team or in the production meetings at that point. And he says they batted around a lot of names for what this could be. They were going to do, they thought maybe Rage in the Cage. They had used Rage in the Cage for an In Your House show the year before. And then somebody came up with the idea, Hell in a Cell. What about Hell in a Cell? And they thought, that sounds pretty good. We'll go with Hell in a Cell. And they took this chain link fence cage, because they were still using the blue bars at the time. So they went with the chain link, but it surrounded the ring and they put a top on it. That was the first time they had ever done that. In WWE, because the rivalry between these two was such that it's the only way to contain Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker was to like rats in a cage, no interference from DX, no interference from anybody. I know, right? It's ridiculous. But they locked them in there and they went at it and they had a classic. These guys always had chemistry from day one, going back to the Ground Zero match. We all know what happened. They got out of the cage. Michaels was a bloody mess. They went up to the top of the cage. They brawled up there. We had never seen that before. In this company, we had never seen that before. Now it's commonplace. It's almost like you can't have a big epic Hell in a Cell unless you go up to the top and take some stupid bump. But they're up there. Michaels took like a half bump kind of off the side of the cage. They got back in. Undertaker gave him a disgusting chair shot to the head. And then the lights went out, and we all know who came out next. It's got to be Kane, and out came Kane, and he pulled the door off the hinges, looked like, you know, the biggest monster in the world. And he went face-to-face with The Undertaker. His pyro goes off, except for that one little hiccup. The pyro didn't go off in one of the corners, but that's all right. And he picks up Undertaker, gives him a tombstone, leaves him laying. Shawn covers, gets the win. They zoom in on him. He's this pool of blood, like a puddle of blood. Has just pooled by his head, and Shawn Michaels wins, and Shawn Michaels therefore became number one contender for the title at Survivor Series in Montreal. Everything about this match was perfect. The build-up to it, these were two guys who hated each other. This is what the Hell in a Cell stipulation was literally originally designed for. It was to blow off a blood feud between two guys that absolutely hated each other's guts. That's what it was designed for. And they went in there and they had what I still maintain to this day is the best Hell in a Cell match that this company has ever done. Of all the Hell in a Cell matches they've done, Undertaker and Mankind is the greatest spectacle. But in terms of a match and just everything that went into it, you throw the Kane debut in there. They debuted this new character. I mean, who knew 20 years later he would still be around? I mean, who knew the longevity that he would have? Everything about this, the story they told, the action, The chemistry between the two of them, the Kane debut, still the greatest debut in company history. I got to put Jericho at number two. It's not as good as Kane. Everything about this just could not have been built up any better than it was. So there you go. That's my top 10. Ranked from 10 all the way down to 1 as far as what I think are the 10 best matches in your house history. Real quick, just some honorable mentions who I couldn't fit them in on the list, but I do think they're worth going out of your way to check out. Bret Hart and Hakushi, the opening match of the very first In Your House show in May of 95. I thought Bret Hart and Hakushi had a very good match. Bret wrestled twice that night, later on against Lawler, but the match with Hakushi was better. Bret Hart against Jean-Pierre Lafitte, September 1995, In Your House 3. The match itself was very good. It was a very good match. The storyline and the angle kind of leading into it was not. He stole Bret Hart's ring jacket. Bret Hart would come to the ring with those black and pink like leather ring jackets. And Lafitte was a pirate. So he basically pirated Bret's jacket. This was a match built around, you stole my ring jacket, I want it back. Yeah. Not the deepest story that this company has ever come up with. And in fact, Bret Hart himself, and I don't remember where, this was some book or interview or something. he even called the reason for this feud, he said it was pathetic. And Bret injected some common sense into this. He said it was pathetic. He says it was the worst storyline of his career. He goes, why wouldn't I just go out and buy another jacket? Why did I have to fight this guy to get my jacket back? I would just go out and buy a new one. Well, that would make too much sense. But then we wouldn't have gotten that great match at In Your House 3. Shawn Michaels and Owen Hart, In Your House, Rage in the Cage, February 1996. Probably the best match I've ever seen these two have. This was an excellent match. They did the post-concussion injury angle on Raw after the Survivor Series in November of 95. I remember that night. I remember that night as a wrestling fan. People thought it was real. Is it real? Is it not real? It was an Owen Hart, enziguri to the back of the head, and Shawn collapsed, and they sold it like he was dead. They sold it like, you know, it's post-concussion syndrome. So that's kind of where their whole feud ties back to. Shawn won the Royal Rumble in 96, and then Owen kind of baited him into giving him a match and saying, look, I'm the one who almost ended your career. So Shawn said, all right, I'll wrestle you and I'll put my WrestleMania title shot on the line because I'm a moron. And he did. And so they wanted you to think that Owen might win. Because if Owen wins, he gets to challenge his brother Bret. We get another Bret-Owen match at WrestleMania for the championship, but it was not to be. Shawn, of course, won, but this was an excellent match. And last but not least, here's another match you should check out if you have time. Breakdown In Your House, September 1998. I believe they were in Canada. I want to say Hamilton, Ontario, maybe. Mankind, The Rock, and Ken Shamrock. Triple threat steel cage match. They were still using the blue bar cage at the time. Winner becomes number one contender for the WWF title. The Rock won. So he became number one contender, which was really for nothing because the championship was held up. It was vacant right after. And then Rock ended up going to the Survivor Series in the Deadly Game Tournament. He won the championship anyway. When Rock came out here and made his entrance for this match, you know, Austin was the number one. He was the A number one guy. Nobody was going to dispute that Stone Cold was the guy at the time. When Rock came out, this was that little period of like 2 months or 3 months where he became a babyface. The fans turned him babyface. But then he joined the corporation and he went heel. And we got corporate, you know, we got corporate champion Rock. But he came out that night and the reaction he got, you knew. Like, this guy is going to be the next superstar. He'll be up there with Austin or you know, after Austin. Imagine they had two mega babyfaces at the same time. How fucking lucky was this company? They could barely create one today. They had two of them at the same time, and they could afford to turn one because they already had Austin. So they could turn Rock, even though he became babyface again a few months later anyway. So triple threat cage match at Breakdown. Give it a watch. I think you'll enjoy it. That's all I got for you. I hope you enjoyed this. I hope it took your mind off everything and you had fun, and that you guys will go check out some of these matches because they are really good. They are, you know, classic matches. They're on this list for a reason. Subscribe, give this video a thumbs up if you would be so inclined. Join me live tomorrow night right back here for my AEW Dynamite recap at 10 p.m. here on the YouTube channel. And live again Sunday night, immediately following NXT TakeOver In Your House. It's going to be my first opportunity to do an In Your House. I never thought I would do a live recap for an In Your House. I thought In Your House was dead and buried in the last century. And then they had to go dig it up and bring it back. So I'm going to be reviewing In Your House on Sunday. Join me then. Take care, guys.